Yeah, it's great to be back. I can't believe this is the fifth time. I think I'm good with this. In fact, one of the times I was here, I remember it was after I had
ruptured my quad tendon on my left foot. I remember he said,
a little more.
He said he was on
the crutches.
And he told me, he said, "You're lucky because up till last week you had to help me put my pants on."
That's right. And there's something, I have to say, there's something about giving talks on it, and this is much more. I had a straight leg splint and two crutches, and the thing I have to say was a little wobbly, and so it, you know, sort of kept me on my toes. And so you, it's funny how you remember those things. But for those of you that don't know, a bunch of you I recognize because you've been here maybe once or twice. And so, yeah, let's get this worked out. How are we doing?
And what's funny,
tracked me, if you sort of looked at my resume or the books I've written and the stuff I've done, The Privileged Planet is actually fairly early in my career. Astronomer Guillermo Gonzalez and I, we wrote The Privileged Planet. We started working on The Privileged Planet. I was actually in my early 30s when we started on this thing. Right after I had moved to Seattle, I
was working at Discovery Institute. I was working on something called.
This is a physics argument for the existence of God. And there was this young astronomer at the University of Washington that wrote a piece
in the Wall Street Journal. It's kind of a grumpy, testy
piece. Claiming that every, you know, rock that they found on Mars proved that there were extraterrestrials. And so he just sort of dashed something off. Now, I can tell you, it's like, if you write a really good piece, there's a 1 in 75 chance.
And send it to the Wall Street Journal, and it's good.
75 chance that they will publish it. So the only time Guillermo ever did this, he sent it, they published it. And I read it, and I thought, this guy's at the University of Washington, literally 3 miles away. And so I called him and said, "Oh, you know, I'm at the Discovery Institute. We are doing this intelligent design stuff." He goes, "Oh, yeah, no, I've been following you guys for years, actually." You know, Guillermo, he would never have called, actually. He's super introverted. And so it's funny because that weird just moment where I called him, I said, I've got this idea, this paper that I've just published called Wonderful Eclipses in a magazine. It's a science or astronomy magazine called Astronomy and Geophysics. And so I went over and we had lunch at the University of Washington and started talking about this idea that we eventually developed in this book, The Privileged Planet, which came out in 2004. And so the reason I'm talking about it tonight in part is because we told ourselves, Guillermo and I, we said, as you'll see in a minute, perfect solar eclipses and the production of eclipses was sort of the clue that led us to the argument that we developed in this book. And so the book came out in
2004, and we knew that in 2020,
going to be a total solar eclipse in the United States. So we said, hey, we should write a 20th year this, literally in 2001. And then we actually did it, you know, and so that's what happened here a few weeks ago. The book came out, and it was nice to be able to update it. It was also nice to be able to update it because the argument hadn't been refuted, because we, in fact, made a bunch of risky predictions.
In the last chapter of the book, there's an
this to happen. And if you think there's a way to refute our argument, let's give you 10 ways. Guillermo, for his part as an astronomer, actually has suffered white martyrdom as a result of writing this book. Yeah, I don't know if you guys know the term white martyrdom. Red martyrdom,
where they kill you. White martyrdom is where they go after.
And so he is an extremely accomplished physics and astronomy publisher. He was at Iowa State at one point. The atheist religion professor led a campaign against him to get him denied tenure because he wrote this book, The Privileged Planet, and succeeded. And, oh, okay, so you go.
So this is the new version.
Rewriting a book that you've written 20 years before, one of the first things you discover is that you were not a good writer 20 years earlier. Like, oh man, I can't believe it. And so, or ideally, to put it the other way, is that you become a better writer.
It's
But the book, I mean, what's funny about
many of you have read it, or maybe some of you have seen the documentary. It's because of the documentary. There was a documentary film that was produced about the same time, just came out a few months after the book came out in
2004. And believe it or not, it was on
in the United States in that year. So that's a different universe, obviously, right? That's a different timeline where something arguing for design in physics could show on a PBS. But as a result of that, there's a lot of attention, and so that drew the ire
of, say, Carl Sagan at the lights.
And so Guillermo actually suffered
dramatically. Now, he's ended up on top, because I told him, after getting tormented at various universities.
Our friend Bijan Nemati was a physicist and was working
at the Jet Propulsion Laboratories, which is a NASA facility.
Moved to the University of Alabama, Huntsville, which is where the satellites are. So if you want to know where the weather satellites are sort of controlled, they're in Huntsville, Alabama. And so Bijan had a contract with NASA, and he hired Guillermo to work at NASA. And so Guillermo moved to Alabama. And then COVID
came, and then they wanted to make him get the vaccine.
So then they just started their own private company called Telescientific.
And their one client is NASA. It's satellite testing.
It all kind of comes back around, but that is basically a 20-year torment of an astronomer simply because he had the idea to write a book with a philosopher and to do it before he had gotten tenure. So there maybe is a lesson there. I'm not exactly sure what it was. We actually had this conversation. I said, when the book was about to come out, he's a good
idea to publish a book like this, right? You know, before you've actually gotten tenure. And he said,
I mean, gave us the idea when he gave it to us. I mean, it doesn't seem like it would be right to withhold it. And that's all the thought he ever had from it. So that's all sort of background. But so what I want to do tonight is basically give you the argument for the privileged planet. The problem
with this argument is it's what philosophers call the cumulative. So what that means is an argument that to work really
lots of examples. And so that's impossible to give you the basic idea. So I hope at the end of the evening you'll know what I'm talking about,
and we'll at least have a much
greater idea of what a remarkable world we live in, and remarkable in a way that very often people aren't even generally aware of. And a lot of this the stuff we talk about in the book is it happened. The argument happened when it did. Because the evidence wasn't actually available until recently. Now, that's an exciting prospect. I mean, there are philosophical arguments that have been, you know, perennial arguments for 2,000 years that are still good arguments you can formulate for the existence of God. But then there's some arguments that are based upon things we discover in nature that we discover at a particular
time. And so there are different kinds of arguments.
Because the natural world has disclosed itself to us in some way, or we have managed to uncover something that was there all along but we didn't realize. But the reason the argument of the privileged planet is controversial and really
is because
go directly after materialism. I don't know that Dick knew I was going to quote Sagan, and so he kind of scooped me there. But Sagan, so for Gen Xers like me and boomers, you'll know who Carl Sagan is. If you're younger, just say Neil deGrasse Tyson or somebody
like that, right? So Carl Sagan was a science popularizer in the 1970s and
1980s. A really famous series on PBS called Cosmos that Dick actually quoted from. And there's also an accompanying book. And when you watch this documentary on PBS, which played for years and years, over and over, Sagan, in the voiceover, says this. He says, "The cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be." Now, if you happen to have ever gone to a liturgical church, there is a song, there's a prayer called the Gloria Patri, "As it was in the beginning, is now and ever shall be, world without end, amen," referring to God. Now, Sagan's a smart guy and a cultured guy, and so he knew what he was doing here. He was doing what Paul said the fallen mind does, and when it worships and serves
the created things rather than the creator, it attracts those things that ought to be reserved to the
created order. So that's exactly what he's doing here. So you notice, not God, but the cosmos is all that was, is, or ever was, or ever will be.
It's the fundamental reality. Right? So think
global materialism, not materialism in the sense that you try to buy a lot of stuff. I'm talking about philosophical materialism, which is just the idea that matter is all that matters, that everything
is finally reducible and can be explained
in terms of mind or transcendent God or anything like that. And because we went after this idea, that made the book controversial. Even though if you read it, it's not really a theological book. Now, so materialism is the big idea, but in something called the Copernican principle. Now, I won't go into the background. The Copernican, that would give you a hint, that's referring to the guy Copernicus. Copernicus was the Polish, he was actually a canon. Wrote a book called On the Revolution of the Heavenly Spheres, and he's the one that proposed that rather than thinking of the Earth as a sort of the stable center with the planets and the sun and the moon going around it, he proposed that, in fact, we think of the Earth as itself
a planet going around the sun with the other planets, the moon going around us. It's actually
make more sense if you think of it this way. And it took about 100 years before the idea basically caught on. Now, that's Copernicus's idea. It's like not all that significant theologically. It's not like, oh, God would have
had to have made the Earth so that it had
everything. These things in different ways. But in the 19th century, materialism
came to sort of to occupy
the academic heights of influence and power, what Marxists call the commanding heights of culture. And so materialists
needed an origin story. So materialists,
what science has done is it showed us that religious superstition
has held us back. And whenever
discovery has been made, it's showed us more and more and more how insignificant we are in the scheme of things. So we used to think that we were on the Earth and we were the center of the universe. And Copernicus told us, oh, no, we're not. We're just a planet, another planet like the other
planets. And this is the claim. Is that this is
finally, in the 20th century, we realize that we are in an unremarkable part of the universe, in an unremarkable galaxy, a tiny little speck around a mediocre star in some boring suburb
of the galaxy. That's the idea.
And so there's another popularizer of science is Bill Nye, the Science Guy. I hate even to mention him. He's not actually a scientist. He has, I think, an undergraduate degree in engineering, which is great.
He loves to say this, and he will give sermons.
And our location is in the universe. And Sagan himself, prior to Bill Nye, actually made this idea really, really popular. And so there's a book, another book that Sagan wrote, other than Cosmos, called Pale Blue Dot.
And so Pale Blue Dot is
Sagan's reflection on an image that he was responsible for. So most of you maybe remember in the 1977, we sent two satellites into the outer part of the solar system.
Called Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. One is now out way past the orbit of Pluto.
Made object out from the Earth at this point. And when they reached the outer part of the sort of planetary part of the solar system, about the orbit of Neptune, Sagan went to NASA and asked them if they would turn the cameras around on one of the Voyager satellites and take a picture of the Earth from 4 billion
miles out. Now, the purpose of the satellites is actually
the outer part of the solar system, not to take a grainy picture from 4 billion miles away, right? But he was able to persuade NASA to do that. And they took the picture, became this famous pale blue dot picture. And it is an image, if you look at it, it looks like there's this kind of beam of light coming across.
And the Earth is a little tiny speck
of the beam of light. Now, the beam of light is actually just the result of,
you know, when you have a camera and you really zoom something,
things happen. But it didn't really, he didn't like it because people saw it and they thought, oh, look how Earth is nestled in this little beam of light. You know, people will think that we're somehow special. So he had to write a book to just,
you know, discourage people from that interpretation.
Here's what he says about this pale blue dot image. Because of the reflection of sunlight, the Earth seems to be sitting in a
beam of light as if there were some special
small world. But it's just an accident of geometry and optics. Our posturings,
our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we
have privileged position in the universe are challenged by this point of pale light. Our planet is
a lonely speck in the great enveloping world. In our obscurity and all this vastness,
and
help will come from elsewhere.
The most depressing
possible sermon you've ever heard.
And we literally named the book The Privileged Planet as in partly an homage and partly a dig at Sagan's interpretation. Because, of course, there's nothing about the picture that requires that interpretation. Right? I mean, it's obviously Sagan's a materialist. You know, he's bringing those assumptions to the data. It's just a picture
from the Voyager satellite. It wasn't designed to take
miles away. But he was afraid that the way it turned out, people might think there was something special, and so he had to do his best to stomp it, like a cockroach on in the kitchen in the middle of the night, right? That's what's happening here. But this has in some ways kind of shaped unnecessarily and artificially the scientific imagination and the imagination of many people who understand and imagine that this is what science has given us. But of course, science, natural science, properly construed, is just a systematic search for the evidence or the causes of the natural world. It's like, let's study nature, let's do it systematically and carefully and try to uncover the principles and laws that explain how it works and why it does the things that it does. It's not about this, right? There's nothing about
the scientific procedure itself that requires this.
What's interesting is at the time that Sagan wrote that in 1980, he wrote the pale blue, or he wrote Cosmos in 1980. He said the cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. The scientific consensus in 1980
was that the universe had not always existed. That it came into existence in the finite
past. Sagan's materialism was already shopworn and obsolete when he articulated it in 1980. And when he wrote Pale Blue Dot in 1996, we were actually just starting this new adventure of discovering
extrasolar planets. In fact, we were still many years.
And so Sagan's prediction, right, insofar as it's
kind of scientific claim, would be a prediction that there's nothing
more exceptional about the Earth or its location or position in the universe, right? But is that true? Right, this isn't just, it doesn't have to just be a kind of philosophical question. It could be actually a scientific question. Okay, if we're to compare the Earth and its conditions with other places and known places in the galaxy and in the observable universe, is it actually true?
Or in fact, is the Earth
compared to the other places that we could be in the universe? And if so, what does that mean?
Right, because whether we're rare or common, that's
from whether we're
significant or here for a purpose. But materials together. And so what we want to do in the book is first summarize all
eight about what it takes
to build even a single planet where life exists.
How that sort of applies to this wider question of purpose. So here's what's interesting. The assumptions are nothing unusual about the Earth. Remember, that's the Copernican principle idea. Nothing unusual or exceptional about the Earth. Have we found another place with life on it? No. Now, in fact, when the book came out, we were just starting to discover extrasolar planets. And every time a scientist, they would discover one, I would get a call, or Guillermo would get a call and say, well, what about this? This is the most Earth-like planet ever discovered. And it said, okay, yeah, it's a gas giant in this weird elliptical orbit. There's no life there. It's a disaster. And so finally, this gets tiresome. And I said, when you find a planet that's at least as Earth-like
as Mars, give me a call, right?
Earth-like planet other than Earth that we know of. And it's utterly lifeless. Now, why is that? That's a clue already, isn't it? That, gosh, that's amazing, because we're in a solar system that has a habitable planet in it. So it's got a star that's good for life, presumably, right? And yet, Mars, which is similar in size and composition, that's just slightly outside the orbit of the Earth, doesn't have any life on it. Now, why is that? Well, it happens just from what we know of physics and chemistry. If you're wanting to know, okay, what would be needed to build a single Earth-like planet? Turns out, just from what we know from chemistry,
you can rule out most of the
universe as being suitable for life. Now, why is that? Well, it's a long, kind of complicated story, but the way to sort of the hint of it would be this. What does NASA spend
hundreds of millions of dollars sending probes
and
sort of outer
Saturn to look for? Water, right? Now, is this just because they can't think of anything to do? Right? Well, I don't know. Let's see if there's some water somewhere. No, we're looking for past evidence of liquid water on the surface of Mars. Not for certain liquid water now, but past liquid water. Now, this is not because of a lack of imagination from the researchers at NASA. It's because we actually know certain things about what any conceivable kind of chemical life is going to need in this universe. Notice that if you remember the periodic table of the elements from the seventh grade, which is, unless you're in science, that's when you learn this, and then you forget it in the eighth grade, right? So I'm just going to remind you, it's hydrogen,
helium, right? You got to work your way down.
A bunch of elements.
Right? All the elements in the universe.
You know that that's a complete science. There aren't gaps. There was a time when there were some gaps. We hadn't discovered helium, for instance, at one point, knew something needed to go there.
But all the elements are filled in.
Universe, for some reasons I'll explain in a minute, we know that everything in the observable universe is made of the same stuff.
So we know that if you're going to have life anywhere in the universe, right, with these
chemical elements, you're just going to need a couple of really basic things. First, you're going to
need some kind of element, some material,
right, that can build large, complex
molecules, things like proteins. You're going to need an element that can
code,
like DNA. And you're
going to have to be able to do that, to code information and build large, complex molecules and structures, but you need it to not be so stable that it can't undergo reactions and transformations. And so you're going to need something for those reactions to take place in.
Well, as it happens, there is a perfect candy
on the one hand, and water on the other. Now, what carbon is, carbon, unlike all the other elements, and in fact, known compounds, is really, really metastable or metastable. And so what that means is that it's not so stable that it just sits there, all right, but it's also not so reactive that it just falls apart. It's
the perfect sweet spot between being stable and not being.
And as I said, water and carbon fit like a hand in glove. Also, carbon chemistry is most reactive over the same narrow range of temperatures over which water is liquid.
All right, so think about this.
Carbon chemistry is going to be reactive. And there's a little narrow range of temperatures. I'm going to use centigrade. Is that legal in Montana to use centigrade? It's zero. All right, I know it's a little communist, a little French, but it's zero to
100 degrees, right? Centigrade. That's freezing.
Most of the universe is either way colder or way hotter than that, right? And so there's this really narrow range of temperatures in which carbon chemistry is most reactive, in which water is less.
And so scientists who
actually, if there's going to be life anywhere, it's going to have to, it's just almost certainly going to have to be based on carbon chemistry, and it's going to have to exist in a place where there's a lot of liquid water with an energy source. And that alone, before we've discovered
any other planets, if you think about it,
that the Earth is a very unusual
place already, because it is a
to be able to fulfill that function. Unless you want to be a real curmudgeon and say, there's nothing interesting about life, you know. So a rock is just as interesting as a cheetah. Okay, atheist, you can have that. But this is right. We know that there's something interesting about life, which is why we spend so much money trying to find it elsewhere. Right? Now, it doesn't mean that you just need carbon, of course. You need a lot of stuff for life. So this is
sort of what we would call a periodic table. So-called simple life, like E. coli,
a set of basic ingredients, and complex life, like humans, needs something like at least 24 additional elements. So it's not like all these things are just kind of weird, exotic things. They're really, really important for complicated reasons in order to have life. All right, so that's just take that as background, right? Boring background. And so that I want you to know I'm not being unimaginative when I say, right? If you want to ask the question of how you build a habitable planet, right? You're going to have to take account of this. You're going to need a planet that has liquid water on its surface, and you're going to need to have a lot of carbon available at a minimum.
Now we can get to the question of a habitable. Doesn't mean the planet that has life. It means a planet that could host life.
Right? Where life could exist. So it's not like, well, if you just get some water and you get a star and you kind of stir it around a little bit and then all of a sudden you get a bunch of reproducing molecules. That's not the story. But you
do need liquid water if you're going to have any kind of prospect.
Where there are these kind of basic requirements that are needed for any kind of habitable planet. And this is the topic that the whole field of astrobiology is focused on. Guillermo, my co-author, is actually an astrobiologist. And what that is that's the study of the things that you need in a sort of astronomical environment in order to have a habitable planet. By the way, does anybody know how many extrasolar planets we have discovered to date? So it's only about 100 when the book came out in 2004. We're pushing almost 5,000. Extrasolar planets now. And that's even counting the fact that they demoted Pluto. Right? So we went from 9 to 8 in this system, sadly.
All right, so here's a really kind of simple summary of how to have a single habitable planet. You're going to say, okay, the first is it going to need to be a direct.
Terrestrial means Earth-like, which is not very informative. Terrestrial, just think of it as a rocky planet with a surface. So Earth, Mercury, Venus, Mars in our solar system are all terrestrial planets. They have a solid surface, all right? Jupiter and Saturn, they're gas giants. And then you get Uranus and Neptune, they're ice giants. See, what I've done is I've reminded you without being obvious about the structure of the solar system. And so I'm going to do it explicitly here because I know everybody forgets this. We're a planet around a single star, which is called the solar system, with seven or eight other planets, depending on your feelings about Pluto, right? We are in a larger body called a galaxy. And this is sounding like Kamala Harris explaining astronomy, isn't it? It's a very big body called the galaxy, and we can see it in the Montana sky probably at night right here in Billings because we're looking edge on into the disk of the galaxy. So we're in a galaxy, and our galaxy is one of many, many galaxies in the observable universe, right? So that's the kind of layers of things. But to just get a single habitable planet, you're going to need a rocky planet that's going to be able to support carbon and water-based life. The planet's going to need to be in what's called the circumstellar habitable zone, or the Goldilocks zone. Circumstellar just means around
the star. Remember, I told you you need liquid.
So this is the most
intuitive thing, right? If you're in a very circular orbit around the star and you're too close,
Venus, really hot, right? So if you had any water, you're lucky enough to have water, it's going to get boiled off, right? Now let's say you're just a little too far out, it's going to freeze up, right? Or let's say you're close and you're at a different size and you get close and it's a smaller star. You get so close that it locks the rotation of your Earth.
Planet,
all right, and so basically what you need is you need the right kind of star, and you need a planet that turns out needs to be the right kind of planet, the right size, the right distance around its host star so it's not too hot and it's not too cold. And you also need it to
be in a fairly circular orbit. Not perfectly circular, but it's about as close as you
can. Actually, a lot of the extrasolar planets we're discovering elsewhere don't have that property. All right. And so now it's not, you're not going to be surprised for me to tell you we're in the circumstellar habitable zone, right? That's obvious, right? We wouldn't be here to discuss it. It's just, the question is, okay, how precise does that have to be? Well, we know it's got to be
pretty precise because we've got Mars.
It's in a slightly wider orbit, right?
It's cold and dry. Very much like the Earth. It's a little closer.
100 degrees Fahrenheit on the surface. So not fun, right? Worse than Florida, all right? So you get the idea. You've got a right kind of planet.
Right distance from its host star.
And then that planetary system needs to be in the right location in its galaxy. So just as there's a right spot to be in the...
around your star, so it turns out there's also a place in the right kind of galaxy.
Host life. And I'll talk more about that in a minute. And then also you actually need to be in the right time in the history of the cosmos. So cosmologists talk about sort of zero all the way out to 10 to the 150 years in the future, right? So they're just sort of
projecting based upon the zero. What happens 10 to the 150th year? Right? Because the
Black holes sort of dissipate in radiation. It's very depressing. So, but this is what astronomers do. But it turns out there's just a kind of a narrow segment of time when you actually need to exist. So, right location.
And the right time. So, here's a slide.
Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because, in some ways, believe it or not, this is sort of background to our argument.
But what we have realized is so in the 90s,
H.G.
Wells, prior to the popularity of television, H.G. Wells had a radio show called...
Have any of you ever listened to this? I listened to it when I was a kid, the actual one. There have been movies made, you know, based on it. But so War of the Worlds, what it was, is it's a drama of Martians invading the Earth in these tripods and taking people captive and killing them.
But on the radio, the show, you think you're listening...
And so they said, okay, now we're going to go back to the regular programming and you're listening to this concert for a while. And then all of a sudden there's a guy that breaks in and says, oh, breaking news. Started, you might think it's an actual newscast. And so a lot of people freaked out and thought we were being invaded by Martians. And this is the 1930s.
And so this was at least kind of conceivable.
We didn't know a whole lot about it. Does anybody think we're about to be invaded? Would anybody buy this now? No, because we've sent stuff there. We've seen what it's like. That we're looking for evidence of water now. So that tells you how much we've kind of downgraded in our expectations. And what that is that's a symbol of the fact that the more we have learned
about our near environment,
more distant places, the more
we realize that you've got to get a lot of stuff right. In fact, that's been the overall.
The more we learn, the more it's like, oh gosh, yeah, you got to.
That too, I mean, my word. So this is just a quick.
Of things you need.
I guess you need the right terrestrial planets. Needs to be the right size, made up of the right things, by the way.
It's in the wrong size. It's too large. You can end up accumulating a bunch of hydrogen and end up like Jupiter. Not enough mass. And the gravity doesn't hold enough of the atmosphere, and you don't end up with a useful atmosphere, and so you're like Mars. You need a liquid.
Or like we have, which generates omega and fuel towards the surface of the Earth and the atmosphere.
Large stabilizing moon. Believe it or not, if our moon were to disappear, first of all, it'd mess up the tides, which had serious consequences for life, but it would also allow the Earth to start wobbling dramatically on its axis and create catastrophic climate patterns on the surface of the Earth. So as it happens, having a large, well-placed moon is really important for life on Earth, not something that we realized until recently. We need plate tectonics,
which plays an important role in
the right kind of atmosphere. I'm just going to assert it, but there's really good reason, based again on chemistry, why you need a basically nitrogen, oxygen-rich atmosphere for life. You need the right kind of planetary neighbors. So, you know, the astrologers
believed that the role of the
system played some role in our existence, so that if Jupiter was in a particular constellation when you were born, that that maybe played some role in your destiny.
So I don't think there's actually any evidence of that at all.
Well, the basic intuition, the planets play a role in our existence, is true. As it happens, most of you probably know that even though we mainly talk about the sun, the planets, and their moons, the solar system is also
comprised of, first of all, the asteroid belt between
and Jupiter,
but also a bunch of asteroids and a massive
sea of comets in the outer part of the solar system, which are great, but you want them to stay in the outer part of the solar system.
You don't want them visiting the inner part of the solar system. You don't want them to visit the outer part.
Why? Well, you know, they have a tendency to sterilize life when they big ones collide with planets. But guess what? If you've got large gas giant planets like Jupiter and Saturn, they play a kind of role of sentinel and protect the inner part of the solar system.
Nothing that we would have imagined until about 25 years.
Right kind of single stars. A bunch of different stars, only some are going to be suitable for life. You probably need it to be by itself. Lots of stars in the galaxy, or two or three. The Alpha Centauri system is actually three
stars fiddling with each other's
and gravitational effects. You need, as I mentioned, the right kind of galaxy. You need to be in the right place in that galaxy. You need to be the right time in the cosmos. And you need to be in a universe that is fine-tuned for life. Now, what do I mean by that? The idea of fine-tuning is just the idea that the
universal properties of the universe, so
either the gravitational force constant or the law of gravity or something like the initial situation that would have to have been set up precisely at the beginning of the universe. All those things have to be very precisely tuned, like, you know, resting on a
razor's edge in order for the universe to have
the level of physics. But even when you get that, a precisely fine-tuned universe like the one we're in, lots of
places are still not going to be suitable for life.
Like this. And so in 2004, we were willing to say the vast majority of places that we are going to find are not going to be suitable for life. And in fact, the more we discover, we predicted, the more we would find that, in fact,
just keep needing to get more and more. So that
moves to other. So we can already answer this question: are we in is Earth an unusual place or usual place? Is it an ordinary place compared to the other stuff that we know in the universe, or
an extraordinary place? It's an extraordinary.
It
continues to be the only habitable planet discovered. It doesn't follow it's the only.
But
we found a heck of a lot, and it's very much
place. So that basic assumption of the Copernican principle, there's nothing special here.
Clearly seems to be falling on hard times.
When people hear that, they think, okay, so is your argument this? Okay, so you got to get a lot of stuff
just right to be able to have a single habitable planet.
Therefore God did it.
Is that your argument? Now you said that's not how it would be the reporter asking you the question.
It is.
And, you know, just to say, how can you make such a stupid argument?
But a lot of people thought that was all it was, right? That's sort of it. Now, why is that not a good argument? Well, this is why.
As I mentioned,
universe. So, roughly,
there are, say, 10 to
stars
in the Milky Way. Something like that. It might be
100. All right, that size. And there are about 10 to the 11 galaxies in the observable universe. So keeping that simple, that would be 10 to the 22 stars in the observable universe. And then presumably lots of those could have multiple planets around them.
And so given the fact the universe is so large, it do have to get a lot of things to go right.
Planet with life on it, but how can you tell?
That's the result of purpose or design, or just the result.
How do you know we're not just the lucky recipients of a vast cosmic lottery? Maybe that's what's happening, right? Now, that's not a ridiculous argument, and I'll show you why. Think of it this way.
So you might think, okay,
let's say you can find 13
independent things that have to go right on the planet. And let's say each one has a 10
occurring. Right, so this is a kind of a simple multiplication problem.
But for those of you that have been out of school a long time, and
being a homeschool parent to relearn this stuff, we're multiplying a lot of things that are less than one, and so the product ends up being gets smaller and smaller and smaller. All right, so everything has a 10% chance occurring. You've got 13 of these things, and so that would be interesting. That would be like, okay, huh? It's like you got 1 in 10 to the 13 chance, if we assume this, right, that you need 13 ingredients, each has a 10% chance of occurring. And then there's 10 to the 11 stars in the Milky Way galaxy. Okay, so that's really good to know. That means there's about a 1% chance of having just one habitable planet in the Milky Way. That's kind of interesting. But there are 10 to the 11 galaxies in the observable universe. So that's a lot of chance opportunities. All right, now let me explain to you what's happening.
Let's say I tell you, okay, I don't carry cash. I never actually have.
But I say I've got an American quarter here, and I'm going to flip it, and I'm going to get 20 heads in a row. All right, and you watch me, and I flip it, and I get 20 heads in a row, and record them. All right, now what are you going to know? They're cheating, right? There's conspiracy. So in other words, intelligent design rather than chance. You got it? So you might not have any idea how I did it, but you're going to know, okay, he's got a magnetic thumb. It's a two-headed coin. There's some kind, it's a magic trick, obviously. Now, why? Why? Now, you could say, if you don't, you know, a lot of people say this that don't quite know as much about probability as they think they do. Well, any sequence of 20 heads and tails are equally probable, so what's the big deal? No, that's actually wrong. I don't want to go into why it's dumb on multiple levels. You know that I've cheated 20, right, heads in a row.
All right. Slightly changed.
I'm going to flip this coin and get 20 heads in a row. And no one's leaving until I get 20 heads in a row. And the door's locked behind you, right? We don't even have the water in here, so this is going to be a really grizzly experiment, but I start flipping and I see I get 6 heads in a row, I get 8 heads in a row, I get 9, I get
13, and we do this for days and days and days
and weeks, right? And you see me get to 19 and then I don't do it, right? But then a few of you that are very hale and healthy are still here, and I eventually get 20 heads in a row.
Now, are you going to at that point? No, I mean,
just 20 heads in a row in both cases, right? So we're explaining the same thing. Well, what's happening is that the theorists would say the sort of opportunities
for chance to operate, probabilistic resources,
are much vaster than they are in the first case. Now, you got 20 heads in a row and I only flipped it 20 times. It's much
more likely that I've cheated than that happened by chance. I've done it
No, I mean, you're eventually going to get 20 heads in a row at some point. So you see the point? Well, it's the same thing with planets. So you can't just go from, well, it seems, yeah, you got to get a lot of stuff right to build a single
planet. Therefore, it must be designed.
Because there are
billions of other possibilities out there. And so
say, well, maybe that's just the whole story. Right? Maybe we're just because we're lucky winners of a vast cosmic lottery. And so if it's possible that you can get a single habitable planet in this vast and diverse universe.
And what happens, life forms are, gosh, this looks like it's really nicely suited for us.
It's just going to be chance and not.
You see the dilemma?
There's the question. Believe it or not.
That is just the setup. Here's the question. Additional that I can tell you.
The evidence that you've already heard about how many things you have to get right to build habit.
Then we tip the scales.
Conspiracy rather than mere coincidence. We think there is. It's this. Habitability correlates with measurability. Now, if that means anything to anyone, I will be surprised. That was Guillermo's idea, by the way, for the title of the book. I feel bad saying that because he's not here. We wouldn't be talking about it because the book would never have been published, right? Habitability correlates with measurability. What's that? This is the idea. As it happens, those very rare places where life can exist, where observers can exist in the universe, also find themselves in the best places overall for observing. The rare places
where scientists can exist also find themselves
overall for doing science. Or as we put it in the book, the same narrow circumstances that allow us to exist also provide us with the best overall setting for making scientific discoveries. Or to put it differently, the very conditions that make Earth hospitable to intelligent life also make it well-suited to viewing and analyzing the universe as a whole. In fact, in other words, the places that are most suited for life are also most suited for doing science. Now, I haven't given you any evidence of that yet, but we will do that after the break. And Dick told me to stop at 8, and I'm doing my best, so we will stop and take a break. Thank you.